podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am Brian J. Rowan, your humble host, and as always, I am joined by Danny King.
Hey.
And Nick Newman.
Hello.
All right. How have you guys been since last we spoke?
I did see The Dictator, so.
So there is that.
But we also saw Moonrise Kingdom, so.
Oh, well, lucky you.
And I'd so rather discuss that this week.
Well, you're in luck, because next week we are discussing Moonrise Kingdom. Unfortunately, right. As you said, we will be discussing The Dictator today. For anyone just joining us, this is how we work. We will have a featured review later on in the show, which, as we all know, will this week be The Dictator, unfortunately. We usually have a discussion topic related to film news. Luckily for us, the big film news this week was the Cannes Film Festival, and we actually happen to have a number of film stage writers there, so they will be joining us to talk about their time at Cannes and all the different things they saw and everything they experienced, and hopefully we'll get some good news out of them. So let's go to that now, and then following that, we will get involved with The Dictator. All right, so joining us as our special discussion topic this week, we actually have two very special guests coming to us from the Cannes Film Festival, Film Stage Managing Editor Dan Mecca, and Senior Writer Rafi Azdourian. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, how's it going?
What up?
So,
yeah, we're here. Here in Cannes. It's pretty great.
You're on the other side of the world. You are the envy of probably most everyone who is probably listening to this right now.
And they haven't even seen the view from our apartment yet.
Yeah,
so
it's envy.
It's a magical place to be here in the south of France, seeing the top movies from international talent from all over the world. It's really kind of a great privilege. This is my third year. This is Dan's second.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane to be here. Obviously, this is kind of just, you know, like a film, like a film festival on steroids, kind of, you know, just like everything that you, there's a huge marketplace as well where every kind of movie is getting sold or trying to, you know, get sold. And it's just to watch, like, you know, the crappiest B movies you could ever imagine being sold in the same building where, you know, the new Hanukkah movies, you know, premiering is kind of just unbelievable. So,
yeah. Well, why don't you walk us through that? What is it like, you know, first arriving there? What is the general vibe, and how do you parse out your day in terms of viewing and just experiencing everything that's there?
Sure. Well, after the 45-minute ride from the airport to Cannes, you arrive here and you're immediately stricken by all the promotional posters everywhere, people running around with badges, and it's just kind of a controlled chaos, or actually it's more just chaos, but it's
not much control.
Yeah, but it's just like a filmmaker's heaven, film fans' heaven. It's just everything is bursting at the seams with movies, and everyone wants to talk to you about movies. And it's tricky to plan out your schedule, because oftentimes we'll be seeing four movies a day, in addition to trying to balance writing reviews and then also setting up interviews. Right. So it's a lot of hustling back and forth. And the good thing is that Cannes is at least pretty centralized. Most of the activities happen around this big centralized area called the Palais, which is where all the theaters are. And then you have the marketplace, which is underneath that. So it's like a big convention center. And then you have the international market all along the beach. I mean, the international village, which is where all the pavilions for every different country that's here is represented. And
that's where a lot of meetings take place. And, you know, talking about selling a movie, you know, will go down depending on, you know, where a movie's coming from, you know, who you represent as a country. What's interesting about Cannes is that it's like a small port town. You know what I mean? It's like very much, a lot of the roads are very like French in the sense, like very small, narrow, a lot of old buildings, you know, right. And if there wasn't a film festival, you know what I mean? We got here a couple days early, and it's amazing how literally on Monday we got here 2 days before the festival. It's a small, quaint, like very French, you know, exactly what you picture. And then on Wednesday.
Yeah, on Wednesday, it's just all the fury begins.
It's a lot more cigarettes.
And on top of that, you have a lot of tourists coming into town visiting. And when premieres are going down, they shut down roads because everyone's trying to get pictures of all the celebrities walking up the red carpet, in Cannes, it's the red staircase. But it is a truly magical place. And if you're a film lover, you should try to make it out here at least once in your lifetime. You won't regret it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth the trip. So yeah, we've been having a great time.
Yeah, it sounds like
and yeah, I guess we should start talking about the movies, huh?
Yeah, why don't you start off, just tell us about, I guess, some of the bigger the bigger ones that you've seen, the ones that have had the most hype, and anything else that really caught your eye that was special?
Well, we started off with the opener film of the festival, which is Wes Anderson's seventh film, Moonrise Kingdom, which I think we can both kind of agree was very solid Wes Anderson material. It's a very traditional Wes Anderson film in the sense that it's a return to kind of his form of this ensemble, quirky genre. To me, it felt like a return to Royal Tenenbaums, and I think real big fans of Wes Anderson will appreciate it that way. That said, I didn't think he was really pushing the limits of himself as a filmmaker. It kind of felt like he was retreading a little bit some familiar ground. Yeah. But there are some great performances. The kids are really charming. I don't know, Dan, you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, the charming kids thing, they're charming. They're a little, their chemistry is never really there for me. They're a huge part of the movie.
I think some of the bigger stars seal some scenes. Like Bill Murray has some great scenes. Right. I think Edward Norton is really, really great. This is his first time.
Well, it's just nice to see Edward Norton in something good again. I mean, it's been a long time. It's been a really long time. That's honestly, true. Truthfully, like the nicest thing is to see Edward Norton in something really, really good.
Well, he was in The Dictator.
Is he in The Dictator?
I haven't seen The Dictator.
Really? So. He has like a 2-second cameo in that movie.
We've been over here. We did, however, see a few Dictator stunt doubles running around trying to fool people as if they were Sacha Baron Cohen. And also, The Dictator took over one of the biggest hotels here, the Carlton. And if you see The Film Stage Arrives at Cannes article, we have a whole bunch of pictures to kind of give you a visual sense of some of the stuff we're talking about.
Yeah. But yeah, back to Moonrise. The standout for me was Bruce Willis, who kind of similar to Edward Norton, I feel like hasn't really been.
Bruce Willis is great in this movie.
Yeah, he hasn't really been around in the way that we know him recently, mm-hmm. and it's so nice to see him and also Ed Norton.
And the film just really has a really great kind of childhood sentimentality and a first love kind of feel that it does feel like a really classic Wes Anderson. I think fans of him are going to be pleased when they see it.
I don't think it's going to gain.
It's not going to gain any new followers. Like no one who hasn't seen his other movies and hasn't liked them is not going to rush out and see this.
Then the
next big film we saw was Jacques Audiard's Rust and Bone, which is the follow up to the internationally acclaimed A Prophet.
Correct. Yes. Which I kind of like that film. I'm interested to see what he does next. So how was that?
Yeah, Rust and Bone. Yeah, Rafi, you take that away.
Yeah, I was a huge fan of A Prophet, and I was really looking forward to this movie. It is a great movie. There are some fantastic, unforgettable scenes, and Matthias, I'm blanking on his last name, but he's the star of the Belgian Oscar-nominated film Bullhead.
Right.
He delivers just a roundhouse performance. It's really impressive. I think he definitely could be up for one of the best acting awards here. The film overall, though, feels a little bit all over the place because, and I found this out after seeing it, it's based on a book of short stories of these series of vignettes. And I think what Audiard did was he took these two characters and he kind of put them in the scene into these different vignettes and tried to kind of string it all together. So there is this kind of disjointedness to some of the kind of pacing and the back and forth kind of, we shift perspectives from Matthias, and his last name is Schoenaerts. I'm not pronouncing that right. And shifts back to Marion Cotillard, who plays his love interest kind of thing. And I don't want to go into spoiler territory because there are some pretty big shock scenes. But I do think it has some incredible moments in it. But overall, what am I trying to say? The disconnectedness of the narrative prevented me from really connecting overall with the impact of the film.
I mean, what he's trying to say is that there was a whole lot of bone, right?
There wasn't enough rust.
Not enough rust.
There really was barely any rust at all. So.
I'm looking forward to Rust and Bone 2, Ruster and Boner. I'm excited to catch up.
Definitely
with this,
a solid entry, but I don't think it's the knockout that some people were expecting. But I think Matthias's performance is definitely the standout of that film.
Actually, jumping off that, John Hillcoat's Lawless is probably a big American title that people, listeners of ours, would be excited to hear about. It's the film. It's the gangster picture with starring Shia LaBeouf, Tom Hardy, Mia Wasikowska,
as the good
Jessica
old
Chastain.
What is their name?
Jason Clarke,
Borden Ant Brothers.
Bondurant
Brothers. Yeah, this is actually one of my most anticipated films of the year, so I'm hoping.
Yeah,
It's definitely solid. It's really solid.
Solid is the perfect word, though.
There are some really great moments in this one as well. It's got a great kind of fun pace to it. It's very entertaining. I felt it lost a little steam towards the end, and the ending is a little bit convoluted.
It all kind of gets a little too generic at the end, which I know, Brian, and it's hard to hear, and I apologize.
It's okay.
He's not back. I'm a big Hilco fan in the sense that I love the proposition.
I love what
Nick Cave did with that story. That was an original by them. And
Gary Oldman is criminally underused in this film, which is a shame because he really has some of the standout scenes in this. But I think the guy who steals the show is Guy Pearce as the villainous Chicago enforcer.
Not surprisingly. The big surprise, though, I'll say this, is the screenplay is a bit of a letdown. It's well shot. I actually got to speak to a few of them today, which you can read. I guess this will be like 2 days ago by the time this podcast comes out. But they shot it on the Arri Alexa, and it looks really good. I was surprised to know that, and it looks really good.
Looks great.
John Hillcoat was worried about the way that it was going to look because he had not used digital before, and I think they really pulled it off. So in that way, it looks great.
And Tom Hardy has some scenes that will definitely be bringing Brass Knuckles back into the popular. For sure. There's some awesome scenes of major violence. And actually, one of the other surprises from the film was I thought Shia LaBeouf's performance was. I mean, I was reading a lot on Twitter after the screening that some people thought he can never get past the fact that he looks like a teenager.
I totally disagree with that.
But I feel like he really put some effort into this role.
He was the standout for the most part. I mean,
he's the anchor of the film. Guy Pearce steals every scene he's in, but I feel like Shia really anchored the film well, and it's a solid film. And I think people that are fans of Hillcoat and are fans of this kind of kind of reminded me a little bit of the Coen brothers. What's the first film?
Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, Miller's Crossing. Yeah.
Well,
that's their
gangster picture. That's like first film. But yeah,
it's definitely solid. I think you'll enjoy it.
Excellent.
Yeah. But I feel like, just to kind of throw out a cautionary warning, I feel like people are thinking Oscar for this movie, which is just not even a chance.
Guy Pearce, maybe, but it's a stretch.
But anyway, let's move on. I think financially, actually, might have a good chance in the States. So I'll be curious to see where that goes.
Next up was Matteo
Garrone, the guy who did
Gomorrah. Yes. His new film, Reality, which when I saw that became my favorite film of the fest at that point.
That was a few days ago.
It's a really, really fascinating film about this father of a family that becomes obsessed with wanting to go on to the Big Brother show in Italy. And it has a kind of Fellini surrealist quality to the way that this character kind of becomes so obsessed that his life starts to just crumble all around him. And I was really kind of taken aback by the film and didn't really realize how much I enjoyed it until the end, and was thinking about it. And it has a lot of layers. It's a multi-layered film.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the layers, though, are very like well-placed, which is to say that as Rafi's saying, it feels simple when you're watching it. And then kind of at the end, you realize all that you've seen, and it's beautifully, beautifully shot. And the lead actor in the film is just amazing to watch.
So. He's bursting with kind of the charm that Jean Dujardin had in The Artist. But funny and fascinating story about him: he's actually a convicted murderer.
Really?
He was discovered through a program in jail that allows them to do theater, and that's how he was cast in this part. But after the filming of this film, he went straight back to jail. He's not in Cannes.
His name is Aniello Arena.
And it's a brilliant performance. I would not be surprised if the Cannes jury decides to award it to him just to get a little bit of...
The
best actor, just to give a little controversy and get some...
A little bit of politics. Yeah.
Absolutely. But it's an absolutely well-deserved performance. Yeah, it's up there with Matthias's performance in Rust and Bone.
All right, and now I think before we get into the dogs that we've seen, and there have been some, let's both tell Brian here our favorites of the festival so far. I'll let you start.
I saw what has to definitely easily be my favorite film thus far of the festival, and I tweeted when I got out of the theater that I thought it was a masterpiece. That is Michael Haneke's Amour, which is a heart-wrenching, unflinching look at two people faced with the inevitability of our own mortality. And I don't want to go too much into the details of the plot because it's a fairly simple plot, but it's basically about two older people in their 80s. One of them has a stroke and it basically tests their love for one another. And if you're familiar with Michael Haneke, you know that there's a lot of things to not really, you never know, you can never expect what Michael Haneke is going to do with his films. But I must say this about it. It is probably his most humane film, his most heartfelt film. And that's primarily due to the amazing performances of the two lead actors who are just unbelievable in their unflinching portrayal of this couple. And I mean, I was nearly moved to tears. It's got some unforgettably just harrowing scenes. The names of the two actors, Jean-Louis Trintignant and Emmanuel Riva, and then Isabelle Huppert has a small role as their daughter, who comes and checks in on them. And I mean, if it's any indication, I mean, I think Haneke right now is definitely a runner-up for the Palme d'Or based on what we've seen, which is not a surprise considering he won in 2010 or 2009 for the White Ribbon. He might not win again, but this is definitely, like, for me, the top-notch film I've seen so far.
And then for me, almost in a similar way, this happened one of the last movies I've seen as we're recording this. Thomas Vinterberg's new movie. Now, this is the guy, he gave us Festen, the celebration in 1998. It was his Dogma 95 film, and it's kind of become this classic in every critical circle, just very painfully funny accent on the painfully movie about family dinner that goes
actually
insane.
If you've seen Melancholia, I feel like the first half of Melancholia during the wedding is very reminiscent of the celebration. And obviously, Vinterberg is one of Von Trier's disciples.
Yeah, Vinterberg and Von Trier worked together. And actually, I just learned this. Von Trier wrote the script for Dear Wendy, which is one of the films Vinterberg has made in the last 14 years, all of which have been flops for the most part. So he's actually kind of been in need of a comeback. And I really feel like this film, Jagten, which translates to The Hunt, is that film for him. Mads Mikkelsen stars, and I'm now convinced officially that this guy can pretty much play any character. I mean, he transforms into roles like no one, like very few others. And this film will convince you if you are not, as of yet. Essentially, I don't want to give too much away, like similar to Amour, because it's kind of nice to see the movie not knowing too much. But Mads Mikkelsen plays a kindergarten teacher who is accused of something that the movie is essentially telling us he did not do. And it's about how the town around him, the small town around him, reacts to the accusations and how he himself reacts. And what's really great about the way that Vinterberg handles it is it's so calmly paced and beautifully lensed in the sense, you know, like this is, it would appear to be a straight-laced drama. But the inherent comedy, and it's almost similar to Festen, is just in the ridiculousness of the situation. But it's very dark comedy, of course, because it's all happening and it's very severe, the accusations that are being put upon him. But Vinterberg really makes a point to elicit those moments of laughter where you just think to yourself, I can't believe that I believe this, but this is the world that we live in. And, you know, it's the kind of movie where every note feels perfect. It feels beautifully, fully realized before they even shot, you know, a minute of film. And it's, you know, there was never a moment where I was taken out of what I was watching. And a lot of that has to do to, you know, obviously Vinterberg's amazing writing and directing, but also Mikkelsen's fabulous performance. There's also a great child actress performance here that I would put up against the two kids in Moonrise Kingdom or any other child performance that I've seen.
Southern
so
Wild. That's a great one.
Yeah, I'd put it up against Beast, too. Okay. I mean, you know, Beast is here, by the way.
Yeah, Beast is in a certain regard.
But, yeah, so... Yeah, so I mean that's where we are right now. There's still another week. We have a bunch of American movies.
It's kind of weird. The next, I think after tomorrow or the next day, the next five films
that are premiering
in the morning are all American, all English language, which is kind of unheard of considering that last year there were only two American films.
There was
Tree of Life and Drive.
Yeah, this year is the big year for American films there, or at least English.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, we'll see because so far it's really only been Moonrise and Lawless,
but we got some big ones. We have Lee Daniels, The Paperboy, David Cronenberg, Walter Cosmopolis.
Mud is the last the last film
to follow up to and
I think
Take Shelter.
I think those are the five. But anyway, yeah, so I guess just to quickly finish off.
Killing Them Softly.
Yeah, I was about to say, Killing Them Softly is coming, which is one that I've been looking forward to.
That's in 2 days. So
yeah,
well, I look forward to hearing about all of this. And again, I'm insanely jealous of all of you.
Yeah, you should be.
Brian.
Yeah, next year, Brian.
Next year. Oh, yeah, let's not get my hopes up on that. Fingers crossed, but
fingers
I'm going to.
Fingers crossed.
But yeah, so why don't you close us out by letting us know some of the films that perhaps didn't strike you as positively as the ones we've been talking about.
Well, I think the first two that we want to just mention briefly are two foreign films that will probably not get much distribution here, which are After the Battle and Beyond the Hills.
Right.
One was in a film about the Egyptian riots at Tamarind Square. It's just kind of a...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It approaches the subject from a kind of a backwards point of view, and they hammer the message over and over, and... It's just a sloppy film.
Yeah, it's a very written film, very repetitive. Every scene were explained why this incident is so important and what the political situation is like in Egypt. And that situation deserves a movie, but this movie unfortunately lacks the dramatic.
Yeah, and there was also some unusual. I mean, it's a cultural shock as well to see some of the. There's a whole thing with horses that about dancing that kind of.
Well, those are the main characters. Yeah. Are these horsemen who are essentially tourist trappers who were part of what's called the Day of the Camel. I believe back in 08 at the square where. Mubarak.
I think it was more recent than that, but okay.
Okay, yeah, but Mubarak,
he had hired these guys to Mubarak, just run into the crowds and kind of beat people up. But and then the other film was this Romanian film from previous Palme d'Or winner Christian Mungiu, who won for, was it 4 weeks, 3 months? No, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days?
Yeah.
This was his new film, which was kind of a.
By the way, the Day of the Camel, totally wrong. It was 2011.
It was
apologies for
that.
Okay.
Beyond the Hills kind of reminded me of like a Romanian version of The Crucible, but done in such a painfully slow manner that it's really hard.
Shit, it's 2 hours and 40 minutes long.
Yeah, it's too long.
And there's nothing wrong with the movie.
There's nothing wrong with slow and long movies, but it's just like the point he was trying to get across could have been done a little bit simpler, a little bit more subtle. So yeah, but I don't think we're going to see those anytime soon. And then the other final ones we had was...
Yeah, these are more kind of, I guess, bigger names.
Dracula 3D, which I saw today, which is Dario Argento's kind of 3D film. I mean, it's hard to talk about. It's super campy, super silly. I mean, it's so bad, it's actually really bad. The 3D is not that great. The effects were not that great. It's not scary at all.
Like the Argento name, right?
Yeah, there is one fantastic moment where Dracula turns into a praying mantis for absolutely no reason and rips someone's head off. But other than that, it's just really absurd. And also kind of disturbing to see Asia Argento nude being directed by her father. So
that's nothing new. Tales all the time.
Yeah, so I don't think we're going to be seeing that one anytime soon. And then
I
want to talk
quickly
about Michael. Michelle,
yeah.
Mike.
You can read my review. I put this up a couple days ago. Michelle Gondry's movie, The We in the Eye, is just, you know, look, we all love Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, so let's all remember that. And it's just not a strong movie. He's directing Kids from the Bronx. The entire film takes place on a bus. Very staged. The kids are non-professional. It shows. Cinematography is rough. The lighting's rough. It's very digital, and I don't mean that as a compliment. It's weird. He's got a very distinct visual style, but
it's not
a complete lack, it would appear, of like storytelling ability. It's very strange. I don't know. It's not a good movie. Not see it.
And then
his storytelling ability in Science of Sleep. You could kind of see the cracks there. I don't know how you felt about
that. Well, that's kind of what...
I kind of saw the cracks in Green Hornet. I don't know about you guys.
Well, no.
Eternal
Sunshine was co-written by...
Written by
Charlie Kaufman, so...
Yeah, but I'm saying that's like... sadly, like this movie, I hated Green Hornet. Like, truthfully, hated Green Hornet. And this movie is on par with that. I hate to say it, but...
And then
in the final one...
One last film we want to talk about was... David Cronenberg's son, Brandon Cronenberg, is here with his first film, Antiviral, which I was genuinely really excited to see because it's a young filmmaker, it's sci-fi, it's something kind of very different than a lot of the stuff we're seeing in the fest. And while I appreciate some of the ambitious concepts and kind of some of the minimalist design to the film.
He takes a lot from his father.
Yeah, he's borrowing a lot from his father and other filmmakers too. The lead performer is kind of doing, he's riffing on Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange, who's also in the movie briefly.
Oh, and the name of the lead performer is Caleb Landry Jones. He is a Banshee in X-Men First Class, yeah. And he's also
and it was a solid Mark performance from him, but. Again, a very kind of first-time filmmaker, a lot of amateurish kind of errors and issues, and the pacing is really, really slow, and it's kind of just a little bit all over the place. The people talk in ambiguous terms that are never really explained to the full extent. And funny story I have, because I attended the premiere of this one, and it's actually the only premiere I've attended. When Thierry, the head of the film festival, got on stage, he introduced some celebrities in the crowd, like Tim Roth, who's the head of the Certain Regard jury. And then he mentioned that David Cronenberg was in the audience, which elicited a huge round of applause. And then on stage, before inviting Brandon on stage with his cast and crew, he said, "David Cronenberg, the only reason this film is here." And then everyone kind of was like shocked and guffawing. And then he's like, "Well, it's true." Kind of muttered to himself under the breath. And then he introduced the rest of the cast and crew, which, I mean, that was like typical con. Like only in France could someone get away with saying that. But yeah.
Yeah, this is the place famous for their just kind of theatrical responses to everything. Were you part of any 10-minute standing ovations?
Well, here's what I heard. There was a film that actually we didn't talk about, but I heard it was another Un Certain Regard film. Xavier Dolan, he directed Heartbeats, which came out, I believe, last year, which is kind of like a remake of Godard's A Band Apart. If you haven't seen it, it's okay. It's like very stylish. He's like a pretty boy, kind of like I think he had Heartbeats in Un Certain Regard, and now he has Lawrence Anyways.
And he's only 23, guys. Regard.
Let's not talk about his age.
My birthday is tomorrow. I'm turning 25, and I'm just like, God,
no. I know. It's just hard to hear. And what's even harder to hear is that I did see his film, Lawrence Anyways, which is about a man who wants to become a woman and how he deals with that. It's a very beautiful story, actually. Very long, but totally worth it. And
But apparently that had a 20-minute standing ovation at their premiere.
It had an insane.
Keep in mind, though, on these premieres that a lot of film salespeople, the distributors, they're all in the crowd along with the cast and crew. But still, that's definitely the biggest round. Definitely. And Amour got a pretty big rousing applause this morning at the press screening.
Press loves Haneke.
Yeah, they do.
They love that man.
Was there any booze?
So, yeah.
There was a scandal because, Tree of Life got booed by, three people.
Well, got, a third wave.
I was in that screening, actually, and it was just one guy who booed, and then people started booing that guy. So it became kind of a cacophony of things. I think Tree of Life had a better reception. There was... I don't know. I think Beyond the Hills had kind of a negative.
Well, with the press screenings, it's always funny because you can tell.
You can tell
at the end
by
Beyond the Hills, everyone just kind of at the end, they were just like,
There's one last little film we want to mention that we forgot on the list. What? And that is another former Palme d'Or winner, hour long film called Mekong Hotel. Apachong,
the director,
I can't pronounce. I can never pronounce Uncle Boon May. Uncle Boon May, who recall his past lives. He won the Palme d'Or for that, and he's a very interesting filmmaker. And Mekong Hotel was a project that he originally intended to do with Tilda Swinton, and she dropped out of the film. So he continued to make the film. He just cut out all of the parts he had written for her, and so
meta docu narrative.
I mean, some people I've spoken with think it's the best film they've seen at the festival, which I'm still a little baffled by that. But you have to have seen his other films because he's using characters from his previous films. And literally there is a guitar riff that lasts about 30 seconds that is repeated for the entire hour. And I thought I was going to go insane by the end of it.
But. Yeah, not a strong offering from Uncle Boonmi, but, you know. We move on.
Yeah, still a lot of films
still
to see.
Still a week left. Yeah. A lot of exciting things that we'll have to share next week. So you know.
Sounds like you've been having a good time so far. We got enough to chew over to hold us until next week when you will be back with. It'll be over by then. So you'll have your top threes ready, correct?
Yeah, we'll have our top picks and impressions of the second half of the fest.
Yes, indeed.
Outstanding. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. So thank you for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your time at Cannes.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Brian.
And we'd really like to thank our good friends. We call them good. I don't know if we really think that. Jeff Baer and Eric D. Snyder.
He's the worst.
The host of Movie BS.
Definitely check out their awesome podcast. They've been doing daily podcasts from Con, and we will be joining them on a special episode.
What number episode is it, guys? I think it's 5. We'll be on that one.
So, and they loaned us this awesome microphone so that we sound nice and crispy clean all the way over here in Con France. So big thanks to Jeff and Eric. Thanks, guys. We love you.
All right, and now it is time for our feature review of The Dictator, starring Sacha Baron Cohen and directed by Larry Charles.
Supreme Leader, the United Nations demands that you come to New York and address them.
Fine! We are going to America. I gotta tell you what this
boy Admiral General, welcome to New York City. And while you're here, I highly recommend a visit to the Empire State Building before you or one of your cousins takes it down.
Rise and shine. Nobody's gonna recognize you.
No.
Without this.
Is there any way you could lend me some money? Maybe $20 million.
I'm here to deliver my speech to the United Nations.
Look, it's too hot for crazy.
Okay, so, gentlemen, thoughts on The Dictator. Danny, how about we start with you? What were your expectations for this film? What is your history with the previous work of Sacha Baron Cohen? And what did you think of this movie?
Well, in terms of history, I really enjoyed Borat. I never saw Bruno just because everything I heard about it was just so, so bad. But judging from the scoffs of you two, I think I might have liked The Dictator the most out of us three. I think it exists, it kind of fluctuates unevenly between good satire and just stupid farce. Like, there's basically one speech at the end that's kind of the only thing that really kind of cuts to the core in terms of good satire. Everything else is just kind of stupid gags just cut together. But considering everything, I did laugh here a lot more than I've laughed at recent comedies. And it is only 80 minutes, which is kind of like a mercy move because a lot of other comedies just run so much longer needlessly.
It's pretty bad.
And even this one,
when you're saying that a good thing about a movie is that it's insanely short.
Oh, no, that's definitely true, because even at 80 minutes, you definitely get the feeling that there are some scenes here that could have been cut shorter or just scrapped entirely. I think maybe the one that just went on the most for me was this awful birth scene that was just horrendous. But I would honestly say that maybe 2/3 to 3/4 of the scenes got a laugh for me. And I'd say I couldn't say the same about a lot of other things I've seen recently. So there's that.
Your ratio is much better than mine. But
before
we get into my ideas on this movie, Nick, how about yourself? What is your history with Sacha Baron Cohen, and what did you think of The Dictator?
History with Sacha Baron Cohen, I've actually seen like a good amount of what he's done. I did see Borat, but I didn't see Bruno. Just it kind of just passed me by. And you know, I like most of his comedy, even if it's kind of a little one note. It's basically an ethnic character and kind of mispronouncing words with their accents, and that's kind of what The Dictator is too. It's just sort of like it's just jokes kind of based on him being a fish out of water and being in this country that he's not accustomed to, but you can only really do so much with that. And even at 80 minutes, there's a point after like an hour you're just kind of like, okay, yeah, we get it, he can't fit in this world. And it becomes really kind of tedious. But even everything that came before that was only intermittently funny. I mean, there are good moments, but for the most part, I just kind of found myself sighing at it. You know, I mean, it's not even the best movie the best comedy I've seen this year, where Catherine Hahn gives birth on screen.
Wait, so. what is the other movie where that happens?
Wanderlust,
by
David Wayne, which deserved to make like at least 3 times what this did this weekend.
That was pretty good.
Yeah. I never got to see Wanderlust, though I wanted to. But my thoughts on The Dictator. I guess I hated it the most of the three of us, because you keep mentioning like laughing at stuff and even just being intermittently funny. And I just kind of sat there in this state of like odd boredom the entire time. Jesus, I don't even know how to properly articulate.
It's pretty dull overall.
Yeah, it's a
Nothing even going on, like, in terms of, like, just if you want to admire any technical craft, there's none of that.
No, it's like, you know, point-and-shoot filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And the worst part is that it felt like a mid-90s comedy, but not in a good way. Like, it was just very, like, we don't have to have a story. We don't have to do anything interesting. Like, if we just kind of go to an excess, then people will laugh because we'll shock them into having to laugh, like, almost as a defensive mechanism. But it doesn't really work that way anymore. Like, you know, you mentioned the birthing scene. There's some pretty shocking stuff that happens there. But all I could think was, you know, why is this still happening? The running gags with him being the fish out of the water, it just didn't work for me because it was just, there was nothing clever about it. It was very simple. It was like if you and your friends got drunk and were like talking about a movie idea and this is it and you came up with it and you're like, oh my god, that's hilarious, and then like you sober up and you realize that it wasn't, but they never sobered up in the making of this movie. There's a running gag where he will just replace random words with like a bunch of guttural, you know, MIDI sounding syllables, and people in my theater were laughing.
It's literally gibberish.
Yeah. He's like, it's my way or the way. And I'm like, that's not funny. That's just, why is that funny? Like, and there was a part of me that was like wondering, like, is this a test, like a racism or xenophobe test, where like if you laugh at this stuff, you like prove yourself intolerant? Because like I just, and it's not even like intolerant in a satirical way. It literally is just like your friend who like, you know, wraps a towel around his head and just starts pretending to be, you know, from another country and like is saying,
well, we've all done that. Shit.
Oh yeah, yeah, but we never, you know, hope to make millions of dollars off of filming it. I don't know. I don't, and it's a shame because this movie really does have the chance, the opportunity to do some interesting things, and it doesn't, and it relegates all of its commentary to that one scene at the end where there's a speech that Danny said kind of hedges on satire. But even the main thesis of that speech is so confused that like nothing, it didn't go anywhere. It didn't do anything.
And, like, you know, thuddingly on the nose.
Yeah. Oh, God. It was,
I mean, not that it's supposed to be subtle, but there is, it's, God.
Well, I mean, if you want a really good political comedy, Being There, which I believe was Peter Sellers, he plays a very simple gardener whose name is Chance, who was working in a stately manor in D.C., I believe. And, you know, the proprietor of the manor dies, and then Chance is just kind of thrown out on the street. And all he ever talks about is gardening. He doesn't know what the hell's going on, but he just keeps making all these subtle, you know, statements. And people around him, because he's well-dressed and because he has, you know, a very courtly manner, assume that he is some foreign dignitary. And so eventually, like towards the end of the movie, they're setting him up to be the president. Because it's like, you know, if you tend to garden, you know, it's going to flourish and grow, or like, you know, the seasons are like growth and fallow. And so people are like, oh, it's a brilliant economic pronouncement. Like stuff like that is funny and on the nose and spot on, but in a very subtle way. And this movie, he's just like, hey, if you have a dictatorship, you can, you know, have the 1% and control the media. And it's just like, okay, yeah, I understand. I went to college with a bunch of liberal arts majors too. I know what that means, but I just don't feel like I should have to pay for it.
It makes me so sad that you have to drag Being There into this discussion. If anybody listening who's considered seeing The Dictator, just rent Being There, please.
Yes. It used to be on Netflix Instant. I don't know if it still is, but holy God, like such a better movie. And again, it treads kind of the same, you know, basic area of like people in power and things like that. And it's just, I don't know. Danny, what did you think were some of the funny points in this movie? I'm curious.
Well, I was going to mention, what about the John C. Reilly torture scene? Anything doing for you guys there?
I understood why it could be funny.
Okay. The helicopter?
The helicopter was okay.
Yeah, that was funny. Although they missed a really obvious joke that I was kind of disappointed in him that he like completely missed this joke that would have worked a lot better in the scene. Do you know? Does anybody know what I'm referring to?
I feel like this is the worst part about this film.
Well, because I'll just say the scene, you know, it takes place like right outside the Freedom Tower. So it's kind of like, you know, because the joke is about 9/11. You could sort of, anyway.
Well, this is the problem. Like, I remember that scene And I remember thinking, like, oh man, he's totally got to say this because that would be really shocking and out there and amazing. I saw this movie yesterday at 9 o'clock. We are maybe a little more than 12 hours past that point, and I can't remember a lot of this movie, and that is a bad thing. Like, when you mentioned the birthing scene, it took me a minute to actually remember that. And it's not like I was sitting there, you know, taking shots of whiskey and, you know, checking my cell phone. Like, I was paying attention. And that's not, it doesn't feel like it now because I'm just like, what the hell was this movie doing for its 1 hour and 20 minutes of runtime?
There was the Edward Norton cameo, which was...
Oh, that was fantastic.
This is also the second best movie I saw this weekend that features Edward Norton.
I was gonna
And in a certain capacity, Harvey Keitel.
Yeah, yeah.
Think the anchors were funny? I kind of laughed at them.
The anchors were okay. And I did that one businessman who was talking about his obsession with male stars. I would have preferred to see that. But I guess, you know, we're being pretty coy about it. At this point, we can just jump into spoilers. So
much to give away.
Again, it's like an hour and 20 minutes, which is just about what most kids' movies get. So, I mean, there's not a lot to be spoiled. If you honestly care about spoilers for this movie, I don't know who you are. But just to be kind, to be courteous, spoiler alert, I'm going to say don't watch The Dictator.
I would say that what I said to a friend of mine last night was that this movie will work a lot better when it's on HBO in January. Because it's so inconsistently funny, like you can just kind of tune in at one scene, get a few laughs.
Yeah.
Put on something better, come back, get another laugh or two, and then, you know, maybe try and cut through the dead air so you can get a 15-minute movie.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. I'd say if you're on your couch and you have nothing to do and you flip this on and John C. Reilly is on the screen, you can watch. If not, maybe turn the channel.
There are 3 minutes of this movie that you can watch.
Or if they're in Little Aladdin, that stuff is funny, I thought.
All right. Well, now we've moved on to spoilers, so we can talk about the labyrinthine plot that unfolds. How do you begin to talk about this movie? I mean, the log line for this on IMDb is the heroic story of a dictator who risks his life to ensure that democracy would never come to the country he so lovingly oppressed. Like, that's not even quite what this is about. Like, this is the story here of him getting, like, you know, replaced by a doppelganger so that, you know, the oil companies can come in and exploit his homeland. There's an opportunity for some biting satire there, and it all just gets thrown out the window so that they can make jokes about femlit majors and, like, global catastrophes. Like, was there any, like, reason for this movie to be made?
You know, yucks and laughs and...
But I mean, like, Borat...
And the like.
And the like. Borat seemed to be doing something. Like, I don't know that I ever got it as much as other people did. But that seemed to be a movie that, you know, knew that it was lampooning American culture and, you know, our ideas of outsiders and stuff like that. But I mean, like, this movie doesn't subvert or even... grow on the stereotypes. It just takes the laziest ones and just expounds upon them until you're just tired of hearing about it. Like, there's nothing interesting, there's nothing real. Like, I don't even know. Like, it's so frustrating because at the end of this movie he gets married to this woman who is again like just a massive stereotype that's never given any life or meaning, and like their entire romance is complete and utter bullshit, and it's predicated on the fact that she makes a chopping motion with her hand, and then they find out that she's Jewish, and I felt like it was about to get interesting, and then I realized that, oh wait, it was over. Like, there's so many missed opportunities, and I just can't understand what they were thinking. Is there a movie version of this that exists that actually, like, delivers on the subversive promise of this premise, do you think, anywhere?
I can't think of anything specifically, but, you know, I'm sure if you got a group of people together and you had a camera, you could maybe maybe you could make it. Otherwise,
it's just weird. Like, was there any, like, I guess I'm just trying to understand, was there any part of this movie that, like, worked for you on the level that you think it was going for in its marketing, at least? Because its conception seems to have been pretty half-baked.
But, you know, it's like what I said, there, it's a movie of moments at the most. So there are, like, individual aspects I found funny, like kind of the motion he makes when he wants somebody to be executed, kind of that like quick, like throat slit motion, which you know they do about 40 times, and you know, it was nice to see Brooklyn vegans get mocked because those are the worst people in the world.
I agree. Yes,
but yeah, otherwise it's just kind of. I was just kind of waiting for it to reach its conclusion because not much else works. It's so scattershot. And I think part of the problem is that it's trying to lampoon everybody, but it should really just kind of zero in on like one or two specific subsets because, you know, you've got a little bit of the U.S. government with like the racist torturer. You've
got the John C. Reilly character.
Yeah. You've got the vegans, you've got the evil republics, and then there's like the media too, but it's like just choose like two, make a checklist and check off two, and then make an 80-minute film out of that because that might work. Maybe yeah. I don't know. Maybe if the movie was longer, which I shuddered to think about.
Don't encourage that. But you dare encourage that.
If there was a greater length at play here, perhaps you know it could be a more cohesive, satisfying whole. Because it feels sort of truncated as is. Like it just kind of goes from scene to scene. There's no like
what you're saying there. Yeah.
Yeah.
This very weird like just like running down a checklist. And I think that's kind of why I said it felt like a 90s movie. Because, you know, there was just this like especially like an Adam Sandler film. Like there's this sense of just getting it done. Yeah. And I definitely agree with you saying that they have too many targets. Because they can't develop any of them quite as well as you'd want them to. Like, John C. Reilly as the insanely xenophobic, racist torturer gets, like, three lines to get across this idea that, you know, he's an intolerant jackass. And because they only have that much, they have to do it as simple as possible. Which is, so he just says that everyone who's not white is like an Arab.
Did you laugh at that? I thought that was funny. Oh my gosh.
Really? You found that funny?
Why? Yeah, and then why? Explain to me your thought process.
I don't know. Like, am I crazy? It was because I didn't, like, maybe the length, because I knew the length going in. Maybe that was just a sign for me that I knew this wasn't going to be anything significant in terms of its targets of criticism. So, like, if a scene like maybe the torture scene more than his first dialogue scene, if a scene like that gets me to laugh, then I just think, like, okay, John C. Reilly did his job, kind of. And it's, like, it was the same way with the Chinese businessman. Like, every time he was on screen, I laughed. It wasn't, like, a significant attack, but, like, I was just sitting during that movie wanting to laugh, and I, like, did quite a bit of it.
I will say that the concept, I think more than the actual execution of the Chinese businessman, gave me a couple of laughs.
No, that was terrible.
I don't know. The idea of this guy who's just like everyone has a price and he just like gets off on this power thing of like finding out how much he'd have to pay someone to sleep with him. Like there's something weird and subversive about that and just like this idea of greed and like pushing it too far.
Do we have different definitions of the word subversive?
Because it's just like if you take the idea of being able to buy anything to its logical extreme, like you'll get this sociopath who like will seek out people for like no reason other than just to like destroy them or degrade them.
It's a 2-minute gag spread over an hour.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I said the idea of it more than anything else. It's another one of these films, kind of like I felt about Dark Shadows. Like this is like maybe three vaguely amusing YouTube clips that then get strung along with a very much larger plot than it ever needed. I don't know, like it might also just be that this movie gave me such a low bar that, like, I had to grasp for something, and I just grasped onto that because the Edward Norton cameo kind of made me chuckle. Mainly just because I was wondering, like, how they approached Edward Norton. But, I mean, I don't know. There's not much to this movie. I can't even properly, like, degrade this movie because it never tries hard enough for me to really give it any much thought. Like, you walk out and it just is already evaporating from your memory.
Yeah, you said it feels like it comes from the mid-90s. I said this movie feels like it should have come out in, like, 2008 or something, when, like, jokes about the Bush administration would have still carried something, but like, you know, there's that speech at the end and it's like, what, you're making jokes about like the Iraq war and, you know, the Patriot Act, like,
yeah,
it's 2012. Find something else.
I wonder about that too sometimes, because even in a lot of the most topical comedies, we still seem to be dipping back to the Bush well. Do we just not want to make fun of Obama? Is that it? Like, has he done anything? Is it just that he's a boring president and doesn't do anything that could be, like, controversial enough to make fun of? Does anyone have any thoughts on that?
I don't know.
Because I've been wondering about this a lot recently, because, like, people just keep still making fun of Bush, and I'm like, I get it. Like, I got it the first 8 years. Like, we have a new guy. Like, we didn't Clinton
when Bush came. I feel Bush like Bush's persona is just easier to laugh at. You know, like, Obama just handles himself nicely as a presence, I guess. I think it's like as simple as that, because I mean, before the dictator, the trailer for the campaign showed up, and like Farrell, his character, almost without doing much, seems to be parroting George Bush.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's this automatic, like, physical response that I think is tougher to attack Obama with, in a sense.
Yeah, I guess. Obama's just not lampoonable. I don't know. It's weird. And it's just one of those things that made this movie feel so dated and safe. It, like, wasn't trying to do anything new. Like, it wasn't talking about, like, our current military intervention, like, the new things that we've done, like, Predator drones and whatnot. Like, it just immediately just jumped back and was like, yeah, Iraq War, Patriot Act. And it's just like, that's done. It's done, and I've heard it, and I'm not interested. Do something new.
It sums up the entire movie.
Yeah. It does. That's a pretty perfect encapsulation. With that said, I mean, I can't think of much else to say about this film. It's just pretty bad. And again, like, I guess the only good thing to be said about it is, hey, it is only an hour and 20 minutes. You could be stuck in traffic that long. I guess this is a little more comfortable than that. Does anyone have any final thoughts to say on The Dictator before we just skip on to what's coming to the week ahead?
You know, when it ended, I just kind of like, I just sort of felt like I was like in the waiting room at the doctor's office or something, like just nothing. I just kind of like I was anticipating something, and then it's almost like, no, it's like I was in the waiting room at the doctor's office and they said, oh, the appointment's been canceled. You can just go home.
this movie doesn't end so much as it just kind of grinds to a halt.
The camera just stops rolling.
Yeah, it keeps making, because, you know, there's this weird romance, and then like he you know, brings her back home. He says he's gonna do democracy, but it's still like a dictatorship, and then he finds out she's Jewish, and then he finds out she's pregnant. It's like, these are setups for more jokes, but you're giving them just as much as you gave everything else in the movie. The only difference is that now the screen is cut to black and the bloopers are playing.
I did like the little joke where it was the voting booth and like they have the tank come by.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Yeah, it was a cute visual sight gag. other than that, I don't know. Danny, any final thoughts on The Dictator?
Well, just like reacting to the general response to this movie, I mean, most of the reviews have been pretty like shoulder shrugging. It doesn't seem to be making a lot of money. Like, I wonder if kind of his moment of fame is kind of done.
Well, I feel like his entire shtick is just like being some random foreign guy.
Mm-hmm.
And like, while it's shocking the first time, it just kind of stops mattering that much after a while. It's not new, it's not interesting, it's not exciting. Like I said, you know, this movie is just a bunch of retread nonsense that he's already done. And I don't know who he's going to lampoon next. I suppose it could be Australia. Maybe he's going to remake Crocodile Dundee. Please don't do that.
He actually did a good jab at France in Hugo, right?
Didn't he do? So? He did a good jab at France in Talladega Nights too.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So that's
I just when him and Ben Kingsley were on screen together, I was like, man, I wish I was watching that movie right now. Hugo instead, because
yeah, that was strange casting.
I know. It's kind of weird how that. Well, yeah, we have to mention this too. He's so wasted in this film.
Yeah. I mean, most people are, but Ben Kingsley most of all.
But it's like, you don't cast him and then put him in for, you know, 10 minutes. I mean,
yeah, he gets like three evil eye shifts and like two scenes of kind of dealing with stupid people, and then he's done.
Mm.
I don't know. This movie is a lot of wasted opportunities and a lot of warmed over jokes that might have been funnier a decade ago. That's a pull quote. All right. Well, now that we've spoken about The Dictator and all the reasons that you probably shouldn't go see it unless it's on HBO and you're like glued to the couch and can't do anything else, it's time to look forward to the week ahead. We got a couple of DVD releases, a couple of new movies coming out, the biggest of which is probably Men in Black 3, though probably the most exciting for film nerds like myself will be Moonrise Kingdom, and also the Chernobyl Diaries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the wide releases. Coming to DVD, we have This Means War, Woman in Black, Red Tails, The Secret World of Arrietty. That's about it for the really big ones.
Sherlock Season 2.
Yeah, yes.
I did like Season 1.
Sherlock. I actually haven't seen any of Sherlock, the BBC adaptation of...
It's on Netflix.
I know. It's there. I just never get around to it.
It is. It took me a while to jump in because it's 90 minutes an episode. And I was like, I could watch three movies instead. But but if you just kind of,
you know... it's longer than The Dictator.
It is true, and it's much better. If you parse it out, you won't feel guilty about neglecting the best medium. But,
Down the gauntlet.
Like that's even a...
the best medium.
Actually, wait, we left out certified copies being released by Criterion.
Right.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to that.
It's a great film.
There was a long time where I could not find, like, a U.S. region DVD for that. And I was like, if you don't bring this out on Criterion, I'm going to kill someone.
Yeah, it's... please, if you're listening, like, give that a rental. It's on Watch Instantly, too.
Yes, it is.
But I'm sure the Blu-ray will be beautiful.
Yes, I will be buying that Criterion Blu-ray.
Awesome.
Other than that, I mean, probably going to stay away from most of the DVDs coming out, but I know that I am particularly excited for Moonrise Kingdom. You both have seen it, correct?
Yeah. We saw it together.
Do you want... Do you want to give us a little preview of your thoughts on it for next week? We will be talking about it in more depth, but if you could give us like a pull quote-esque statement about what you think its quality is.
That would be helpful. I'd say its quality is pretty high. I think it's Anderson's best live-action film since The Royal Tenenbaums, which maybe to some people will seem like, oh, well, big deal, but it's very good. And I'd like it more the further I get from it. It probably has some of his best directorial work yet, so I can't wait to see it again, actually.
Yeah, I'm a fan too. I think it's... I wouldn't really call it like a huge step up in any way, but but in terms of live action after Life Aquatic and Darjeeling, I feel like this is a really good kind of gathering step for him. Like it's safe in its own way. There's not really any wrong missteps. Like Nick said, it's directed very well. And so I feel like it's just a good thing for him to do to kind of get consensus back, because I can't imagine this getting much like negative response.
That's good. I actually really like The Life Aquatic, and I know I'm kind of a minority on that.
I actually rewatched Darjeeling Limited the night before I saw Moonrise Kingdom, and I feel bad that I, you know, said so many negative things about the movie for like 4 years because I liked it so much more a second time, and I'm going to rewatch Life Aquatic soon because, you know, why not?
Yeah, my thoughts on Darjeeling still remain kind of muddled, but I actually greatly enjoyed The Life Aquatic, so I'm looking forward to Moonrise Kingdom, and you all at home can look forward to hearing us talk about it next week on the Film Stage Show. Hopefully we'll have more to say about it than we did about The Dictator, or even Dark Shadows. It's been a really bleak, like half a month for movies. I'm really hoping that Moonrise Kingdom can pick us back up, because as I said upon leaving the theater of The Dictator, if the rest of the summer's like this, I'm going to kill myself, because I cannot keep just like wallowing in this mire of cinematic madness that I've had to like endure.
So I mean, there's Moonrise Kingdom next week, and then doesn't June 1st have something?
Snow White and the Huntsman?
That might be good. And then the week after that's Prometheus.
Yeah, I'm actually... it's weird. I don't... there's no way to say this that doesn't just... You know, there's no way to say this. I am actually kind of looking forward to Snow White and the Huntsman. Their recent TV spots with Charlize Theron just kind of like glaring out at you and being like, you know, come find me if you dare. I don't know. It's working for me. And I don't know why.
Yeah, I like them too.
Yeah, and at least looks like it has an interesting visual style. And since I'm not one to write off an actor based solely on you know, their one franchise. I'm not going to say that I hate Kristen Stewart, because I actually kind of liked her in Adventureland.
Yeah,
so,
same.
So I feel like, you know, they get a bad rap, her and Pattinson from Twilight. But, you know, she's got Snow White and the Huntsman, he's got Cosmopolis, and I am going to give them a chance. All right, well, that being said, thank you again, all the listeners at home, for joining us on the Film Stage Show. If you have anything you'd like to say, you can always get in touch with us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And you can also find your three wonderful talking heads right here on the internet. Danny, where can we find your work?
I have a personal blog, thekingbulletin.com, and I'm also on Twitter at twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And Nick?
You can find all my writings at thefilmstage.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. That's Brian with an I. And you can also see my personal blog at dearfilm.net. So thank you very much again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next week when we talk about Moonrise Kingdom.